A while back, I was asked why sherry is more popular today than it was 10 years ago, and my answer was actually pretty straightforward. It's because the wines are better. Seriously, really think about it. It's been sort of taken as a given that sherry, maybe because it has such a long history, just doesn't change that much. But look at what's out there today and see how much alteration has really happened to the scene. And Rama bottlings are a good example of something that just wasn't even available to consumers a decade ago. And now there are several to choose from. Plus, have you had the Una Palmas Fino? I mean, seriously, have you had the Una Palmas? Because it's freaking fantastic. Wines like this are the reason that sherry is really more popular today than it's ever been in a long time. For real. I mean, the amazing thing about it is that the wine is just heartrending good, like amazing, the Una Palmas. And it is offered out for like peanuts, like really nothing. It's super inexpensive for what it is. Plus, we're going to do something special here and I'm going to go ahead and offer you an even deeper discount on what's already a low price. Crush Wine and Spirits will take off 10% of the original price for the Una Palmas, taking it down to $28.95 a bottle for you because you listen to this show. All you have to do is call Crush at 212-980-9463 and use the offer code IDTT for me, or use that same promo code online at crushwineco.com, and then you can take advantage of the pricing on what's really one of the great wines of the world, the Una Palmas. Call Crush Wine and Spirits and ask for the special deal available to podcast listeners. I'll drink to that, where we get behind the scenes of the beverage business. I'm Levy Dalton,
I'm Erin Scala.
and here's our show today.
Are you guys ready to get warmed up? Because I am.
The wine legacy of Jerez is linked directly to the region's strategic location. Jerez sits on the Atlantic, just in front of the Strait of Gibraltar, and over the millennia, the region has attracted many merchants. During seafaring years, the city of Cadiz became extremely important as one of the major ports in Europe. Ships passing into the Mediterranean would pass by Cadiz and could resupply. Ships passing out of the Mediterranean could stop and trade or sell their wares. Ships heading west to the Americas could stock up for the Atlantic journey before heading out without entering the Mediterranean or paying any tariffs at the strait. A bustling, multicultural trade society, powered by wealthy merchants from all over the known world, made this region one of the most important places in Europe. Because it's such an important place, especially in the pre-airplane era when distance trading between kingdoms revolved around seafaring, everybody wanted a piece of Jerez. If you look at the important port city of Cadiz, it switched hands many times over a period of 3,000 years. A few of the factions that controlled Cadiz over the years included the Phoenicians, the Carthaginians, the Romans, the Visigoths, and the Moors. For much of this 3,000-year history, grapes were grown in the region and wine was made. Wine production was most likely introduced by the Phoenicians. It flourished under most of Roman rule, but later, under Moorish rule, alcohol consumption was made illegal. But ironically, the Moors also brought distillation to the region, and this helped set the stage for fortified wines of the future. Under Spanish rule, wine production picked up once again, and the Jerez region became an important port area where explorers would leave Europe to head west. Both Columbus and Magellan began expeditions from Jerez, and before they left, they stocked up on, you guessed it, wine, a good portion of which was local. During Spain's conquistador age, the port at Cadiz served as the home of the Spanish Armada, and nearby Seville became, by law, the only place in which goods from the New World could be unloaded from treasure fleets. This made Seville and Cadiz and the surrounding areas extremely wealthy, while also making the area a magnet for all the competing parties who wanted Spain's American gold and other goods. The port was regularly attacked and looted by the British, including a raid by Sir Francis Drake, who crippled the Spanish navy in his attack and brought back an enormous amount of sherry to Britain. Britain wanted Spain's treasures, and Britain also attempted to divert Spanish goods from the Americas to Britain instead of Spain, mostly through privateers, or pirates, who ransacked treasure ships. Spain's answer to the pirates who pestered the Atlantic was the formation of a treasure fleet. The concept was based on strength in numbers. When the ships sailed as a large group, they were less likely to be attacked. Also, with goods and wealth spread between the ships, if one ship were to be looted or lost, the fleet would have hedged its bets and lost just a small portion of what they could have lost as a smaller group of ships.
Conquistadors in America set up highly organized trade routes
that systematically funneled wealth from the Americas to Spain. Gold and silver and other types of goods would be checked in and logged at storehouses throughout the Americas, and they'd be moved and shuffled until they came to one of a few export storehouses. And when the fleets would arrive, the booty would be loaded on the ships in one lump. The fleets would bring all the American loot back to Spain in one group, and they'd pass right by Jerez in the process. The influx of riches meant that wealthy merchant locals could afford to drink plentifully of the local production, and regional wine would find its way into empty cargo holds on the journey back to the Americas. Jerez wines experienced a boon. Spain became extremely wealthy during the colonial period, and the more money Spain had, the better the wine business did. Sherry was being exported around the world from this bustling port region, including the Americas. Sherry was one of the most famous wines in the world. But in subsequent wars, Jerez lost export markets because Spain went to war with them. And more recently, air travel rendered the area's location strategically less important. Sherry once helped fuel colonial trade and the extremely successful merchants who based themselves there. But circumstances have changed. Today, the treasures of the area are not sailing by in the cargo holds of treasure fleets coming from South America. Instead, the treasures lie in the cellars of the sherry producers. If you think about it, the spectrum of sherry wines is as varied as the history of the region and all the cultures and individuals who helped shape such a unique place and product. Stay tuned to top up your sherry knowledge with some insider details from a bastion of Jerez. I guarantee you'll learn something interesting because, how can I say this exactly right? The more I learn about sherry, the more I'm simply floored.
Hey, just a reminder, Aaron's warm-ups can be found on vinography.com, online, and in text if you'd care to read them all the way through. That's vinography.com, where you can find Aaron Scala's warm-ups as text.
I'm Mike Martin, wine director for Vinci Fine Wines in New York City, New York.
Christy Frank, Frankly Wines.
Jason Wagner, Fung Tu Restaurant.
Patrick Watson, Back Label Wine Merchants.
Raj Vaidya, Restaurant Danielle.
Jack Mason, Marcha Restaurant.
Jessica Brown, wine director at the Breslin Bar and Dining Room and the John Dory Oyster Bar.
I've told you many times how great 750 is, but don't just take it from me. There are many, many buyers who are using 750 to make their lives easier every day with access to detailed wholesale pricing, a calendar of upcoming trade tastings, and seamless connections to their sales reps. Check out 750.com for yourself and get signed up. Are you a wine importer, restaurant wine director, or retailer working with direct import? Probably you are because you're listening to this show right now. Well, do you have also a strong interest in expanding your selection of Italian wines? If so, I have a pretty awesome opportunity for you. I'll be leading a group of buyers to Verona in Italy for the inaugural edition of Wine to Wine, a new forum for buyers to taste directly with producers. Wine to Wine has been developed by VinItaly, which is the largest trade show in the world. You've probably heard about it. And this is a new chance to meet with producers face-to-face in Italy, make some great connections, in a little bit of a smaller format. All Drink to That is a podcast partner with Wine to Wine, and we're really excited about it. You have the opportunity to join me at Wine to Wine in Italy on December 2nd and 3rd of this year, because a travel and lodging stipend is being made available to buyers. If you are someone who wants to grow your Italian wine portfolio, this is an excellent chance to do so. To apply to join me and the many excellent producers at Wine to Wine, you should send an email to media@vinitalytour.com. That's media@vinitalytour.com. So VINITALY. POUR.com. You want to include in that email a short bio that covers your work responsibilities and also a paragraph discussing your interest in Italian wine. If the Vinitaly folks like what they see, they'll follow back up with you for some more information. This is a pretty spectacular chance to go to Italy and taste with producers at no cost to you, but you need to have a strong interest in Italian wine and you need to be a buyer. If that's you, email media@vinitalytour.com with your details to get started and I might just see you in Verona. Want to offer some special thanks to Christopher Canali Parola for translating this interview with Antonio Flores. Also, I want to give a shout out to Peter Leem and Jesus Barquin, whose book Sherry, Manzanilla, and Mantilla was very helpful when I was preparing questions for this interview. Great book. Antonio Flores of Gonzales BS on the show today. Hello, sir. How are you?
Buenos días, Levi.
So you were actually born at the bodega of Gonzales BS.
Yo me siento un verdadero afortunado. He nacido dentro de la bodega.
I feel incredibly fortunate to have been born in the winery. My father was the previous technical director of Gonzales Bias, and I myself was born within the winery, which is not just something that you can say to people. It's something that really has a powerful effect on your life. And I always say that in my veins, I don't have blood running through me. I have Tio Pepe.
Hay que imaginarse un poco cómo es Gonzales Villa. Gonzales Villa es una pequeña ciudad.
You have to imagine almost what Gonzales Bias is. It's almost a city within a city. We have our own streets, we have our own buildings, our own houses. We even have our own consulate, a diplomatic consulate there to countries such as Sweden and Italy.
And when did your dad first start work at Gonzales Bias?
Bueno, yo puedo decir que mi padre empezó con 14 años. Era el chico de los...
I can say that my father really started at Gonzales Bias when he was 14 years old. He really began as what you might call an errand boy doing the most basic of tasks and really had the most phenomenal career that took him through all of the different aspects of winemaking at the winery from what we describe in Jerez as a botón, almost like a button, a small piece of the operation, to being the technical director at the very top.
And what was your dad like as a person?
Pues era una persona, pues, con mucho carácter. Indiscutiblemente, para progresar en la vida de esa manera, hay que tener mucho carácter.
He was a really phenomenal man. He was really great at what he did. His reputation still echoes in Jerez as being not just somebody that was phenomenal at their job, very, very gifted, but also somebody with a very big heart, somebody who really helped people. And he, part of the reputation that he's left behind as well, the legacy that he's left behind, is his effect on people that he works with, his ability to be able to help people progress in their careers. When Antonio was young, he was certainly hard as well, and that certainly, Antonio thinks, has helped his own personal development.
And when did you decide that you'd like to follow in your father's footsteps at the winery?
Yo, verdaderamente, fue algo que me llevó la vida a ello, porque yo, mi primera...
Well, interestingly, I don't think that it was something that came to me at the very beginning. I think, like often in childhood, something that your parents do isn't the first thing that calls to you, perhaps. I, in fact, first off, was first interested in joining the Navy, the Spanish Navy. I was very attracted to that lifestyle, and then later on decided that maybe I'd have an opportunity in journalism. And then finally, as I grew a little bit older, I started to spend more time with my father in the winery. I really enjoyed learning about the winery with him. We used to use the Venencia together and explore the barrels together, and it's certainly something that really began calling to me in quite a powerful way. I think it's very natural when you grow up and you spend time out in the winery and start to realize just how magical the wine world is. I also received my qualifications, my degree, from the first university in Spain offering a degree in oenology, and from there on in, it was a clear decision.
What was your childhood like in Jerez?
Pues fue una, yo lo digo y vuelvo a repetirlo, soy un afortunado. Mi niñez fue una niñez.
It was my childhood was more than anything, it was just incredibly happy. I've said it before, and I'll return to say it again, that I'm incredibly fortunate to have had a childhood that was based around growing up in the winery of Gonzalez Bias. It was something that really was surrounded, always. I was always surrounded by a happy, positive atmosphere. Quoting the poet Davio Paz, who said famously that your childhood really is the only real inheritance that we have, perhaps the only real country that we can aspire to belong to. And I'm just very fortunate that mine was so happy and positive.
Yo siempre digo que el sentido del olfato es el sentido más sensible que tiene el ser humano. Y recordándome,
I always think that the most powerful sense that we have is our olfactory sense, our sense of smell. And really, when I think back to my childhood, I think back to those days when I used to come back from the beach with my father, and we'd enter into the house and we'd open our front door and the house smelled of sherry. That's my childhood.
You have Ed Gonzalez Bias, several bodegas. Were those areas for you to play in as a kid? Did you get a chance to run around the different casks?
Parece que Levi conoce mi vida.
It seems like you know my life.
Mi padre tenía una pequeña puerta, que Chris la conoce, para entrar en la bodega. Daba directamente a la bodega. Mi padre siempre...
There was, in my house, when I was a child, a small door that opened directly into the winery. And it was always my dream that my father would leave the house forgetting to lock that door, because that was my entrance to my own little world. I would run out there and play amongst the barrels, and really created this whole universe in which I myself was the prince.
What was Jerez like at that time? Was it a place similar to now, or was it a different kind of environment during that era?
Jerez ha cambiado, porque Jerez, cuando yo era niño, vivía por y para el vino, la industria más importante y más y sobre todo importantísima era el vino, no solamente eran las bodegas.
Really, Jerez as a city has changed quite dramatically over the years. When I was young, we lived off and for sherry. The sherry production was the economic driver of the city. And it wasn't just the wineries themselves that were involved in this business. Of course, you had the graphic companies, the graphic design companies, the bottling companies, and all of the business that comes around wine production made sherry and the production of wines from the region the driver, economically speaking, for the region. And now, unfortunately, there's been quite a bit of change, and sherry production is not the economic driver of the city. So, yes, you could say that quite a lot has changed.
Le voy a contar una anécdota a Levi. Mi padre estuvo trabajando más de 50 años en González Vía. Cuando se jubiló, le hicieron mucho homenaje en González Vía, en Inglaterra, a la familia Vía.
Interestingly, my father spent 50 years working in Gonzalez Bias. And so when he retired, it was quite a big change to the company and indeed to the city. And so as a consequence of his retirement, there was a lot of people that came out to pay homage to him and leave him some words of dedication. But interestingly, the dedication that was the most emotional for my father to hear was from Domecq. Domecq, of course, our competitor in the city, and that's an important point.
What do you think your father's legacy really was in terms of the wines?
Bueno, yo siempre digo, Levi, que Jerez, los enólogos, no somos enólogos estrella, no hacemos vinos de autor. Yo creo que eso es un poco de soberbia por parte de algunos.
I always say that the role of a winemaker in Jerez is not at all that of a star winemaker or of a winemaker of auteur wines. It was certainly more of a humble role, much more of a subtle role, in fact. And it's the responsibility of receiving a collection of wines and looking after them during your entire career, keeping them in not only the exact same level of quality, if not trying to increase it during your career, but also in the distinct style of the house, and then handing it to the next generation of winemakers in the same style and of the same quality.
Algunos de los vinos que llevo a la cata de mañana del seminario de añadas de González Díaz no los seleccioné yo, los seleccionó mi padre. Y muchos de los...
In the seminar that I'm going to give tomorrow about the vintage wines of Jerez, I'm going to be showing wines that I didn't select, but my father selected. And in the same vein, I'm at the moment right now in the winery selecting wines that I'm not going to try. Well, I will try them. I'm obviously trying them, but I'm not going to be drinking them. I'm not going to be showing them. That's going to be for the next generation.
And so when you went to the university and they taught you about wine, did they instill in you this idea of a wine as a multi-generational process? Or what kind of education was it when you went to learn at enological school?
Fue realmente una formación amplísima. Estudié edafología, viticultura, enología, química orgánica, química inorgánica. Eso es una formación básica. Realmente yo la formación real la recibí de mi padre en la bodega.
Well, my oenology degree was in fact incredibly diverse, covering everything from viticulture to oenology to organic chemistry to inorganic chemistry. But you could say that my real training as a winemaker I received from my father in the winery.
So you come back to the bodega, and in terms of making a wine that seems so much about the process of time and about the process of blending, what does it mean to be a winemaker of such a large bodega?
Bueno, realmente, yo siempre digo que una bodega como González Díaz, que tiene dos siglos de vida, todos sus sistemas de trabajo, su sistema operativo...
One thing very important to understand about a winery with the history of González Bias, we're talking about a history of almost two centuries here, is that when I entered into the winery, we already had the production processes very firmly established and very firmly put into place. And really a funny example of this was in the 1990s when we acquired IT systems to improve our efficiency in the winery and to improve the communication, etc. And really we were given an IT system that was designed to help us sell wines. And interestingly, we had to change it. It wouldn't work for us. The IT system had to change itself around the format of a sherry winery because it wasn't at all set up for it in the beginning. So this is certainly something that's very important to understand with the size of the winery that we are.
Imagínate lo que es hoy en día implantar un sistema de trazabilidad en un sistema de criadera y solera donde todo se mezcla y todo se corre a la vez.
Just imagine what it is like trying to implement a traceability tracking system for a solera system in which the wines are just continually blended into each other. It's very difficult to achieve.
Si hubiera un problema importante, afectaría a toda la solera.
If there was a small kind of error or mistake, it could affect the whole winery.
For
Solera itself.
Hundreds of years, yes, potentially.
Yeah, of course.
The Palomino Fino grapes come into the winery. And what decisions are you thinking about? What's important to you as the harvest is happening?
Fíjate, la Palomino Fino, dicen de ella que es una varietal poco expresiva. Y yo no estoy de acuerdo. No hay una varietal...
When the Palomino Fino arrives into the winery, it's interesting. People will often say that it's a varietal that isn't very expressive, isn't very aromatic. I don't really agree. If you look at the huge amount and variety of incredibly aromatic wines that are produced from Palomino, you'll realize that really it is a varietal with a huge aromatic potential. And so when I receive that Palomino Fino into the winery, my first thought that goes through my head is how much free run juice and how much of that light first pressing am I going to need for my Tio Pepe and of course for my rare vintage sherries. That's the first thing that I look to analyze.
How much of the production of Gonzales BS is Tio Pepe?
Nosotros somos una bodega con vocación de fino, de crianza biológica. La mayor parte de nuestros vinos van de...
We're certainly a house really dedicated to the production of fino. So that's really our primary concern when it comes to the volume of wine that we'll be directing into different directions in the winery. I would say that 60% of the Palomino that we receive is destined to be grown into Tio Pepe. And then we have the remaining wine from which we'll derive our Olorosos, our Palo Cortados, our Mediums, our Creams, etc.
And how much of those derivatives actually feed from the Tio Pepe Solera?
Bueno, pues realmente eso depende mucho del volumen de venta, porque vamos, tú haces una estimación teórica del vino que vas a necesitar para tus soleras de fino.
Well, we have our theoretical projections whereby we assume how much wine will be needed for our other wines, for example, our Olorosos, our Amontillados, Palo Cortados, etc.
No,
but really this...
Amontillado adentro de la gama.
Sorry, not Amontillado, sorry. But this really comes from the rhythm of sales. And so to some extent, and to really quite a small extent, we have to allow ourselves some room for maneuver to deviate the aging of wines from Tio Pepe into other aging styles if the sales demand changes, for example. But really, we're talking about a minority. We're talking about no more than 10% ever of the wine.
Los mercados y, por lo tanto, las necesidades no se mueven tan drásticamente de un año para otro. No.
The change of the rhythm of sales is never drastic. It never is from one year to another. Normally, we have some time to see it coming.
And what have the changes been over the course of your career? You started in 1980, and what has been the course of the sherry market since you took over as a winemaker?
Bueno, realmente yo llegué al mundo profesional del vino el 1 de septiembre de 1980, en plena vendimia, y encontré un Jerez que había alcanzado.
I entered into this business formally on the 1st of September in 1980, right at the beginning of harvest, as you can imagine. And when I entered in, I really came at a time that was quite difficult for Jerez, because we were just seeing the beginnings of the decline from what was a much appreciated great wine to something that was less appreciated by the market. You know, a lot in part as well to negative business practices in the city of Jerez of selling in large quantities at very low prices, which really was very destructive. And I really was never sure that I was going to see the day when the wine would return back to its place of prestige where it once was. And of course, this is in part what we're seeing at the moment.
Yo muchas veces, a mis alumnos en el Cherry Master, a los participantes en mis catas, les digo que se acerquen a Jerez sin miedo. Al vino hay que acercarse sin miedo. Y ya se aprenderá con el tiempo. Porque muchas veces digo que Jerez no es fácil, pero también me hago una pregunta. ¿Hay algo en la vida que sea fácil y merezca la pena a que no? Todo lo que merece la pena exige cierta dedicación, cierto esfuerzo para entenderlo. Y Jerez, os garantizo que merece la pena.
I always say to my students of my Sherry Master course and the people with whom I share tastings, I always suggest to approach Sherry without fear, approach it confidently, discover it confidently. This is certainly not always easy as a wine, but I always say, is there anything easy in life that's worth achieving? No, to be honest, everything worth achieving in life requires a certain degree of difficulty. Jerez certainly has that in its wines, but it's certainly something that's worth the challenge.
It must have been quite scary to take over at a part that feels like the start of a decline. Right as you arrive, it seems like the market tends to shift. And given the example of your father, it must have been a lot of pressure on you to try to succeed.
Es difícil y da muchísimo miedo, sobre todo cuando eres hijo de una persona que... que ha sido muy importante en el mundo del vino, y tú eres para todos los demás el hijo.
It was difficult. It was certainly scary in the early days, coming into the company at a difficult time for the market, but above all, being the son of Miguel Flores. You know, for as we say in Spanish, someone that's plugged in, you know, somebody that the rest of the winery in the beginning of your career see as being the boss's son. It certainly makes it difficult when you have before you your father, who has done such tremendous work and developed such a tremendous reputation in the region. You really have to prove yourself to be as good as, if not better, than the legacy left by your father. I hope that I have perhaps come close to this, but it's certainly something that was very difficult in the early days.
So Tio Pepe is one of the most widely distributed sherry brands in the world. And how many casks are represented by the Solera for Tio Pepe? Are we talking about 10,000, 20,000?
Hay actualmente aproximadas botas arriba, botas abajo, 21,400 botas.
Right now, including all of the wines that we have in the whole system and all of the criaderas and all of the soleras, we're talking at around 21,400 barrels.
And how do you maintain consistent quality across that many separate barrels?
Realmente es el secreto de Tío Pepe, ¿eh? Porque todas esas botas están repartidas en distintas soleras que están en distintas bodegas, donde la flor, de alguna manera, la levadura se comporta de una manera diferente dependiendo del grado de humedad, de la temperatura de cada bodega. Reproducir ese sistema en cada bodega y que después el blend de toda esa solera hace que Tío Pepe sea inimitable, porque hay que tener 21,400 botas y 20 soleras y hacer la mezcla. Eso es muy difícilmente imitable.
This really is the secret of Tio Pepe. Having so many barrels across the 20 soleras of Tio Pepe, all in different bodegas and all with barrels in very different locations within each bodega. Within each barrel, of course, in each of these locations, in each microclimate, we see the flor yeast responding very differently. And really the skill and the art of maintaining Tio Pepe as it is, it comes down then into the blending of maintaining that constant blend from all of these different soleras, which give you wines of different personalities.
So how should I understand flor in terms of what it does and how it acts differently in different places? How should I understand this force?
Yo digo que la levadura, la flor, es una auténtica superviviente. Se adapta al medio. Se adapta al grado de humedad.
Really, there are four key different types of Saccharomyces yeast, and understanding the different personalities and different movements of each of these different four types of yeasts is the key behind understanding the growth of the flor yeast. So firstly, we have the Saccharomyces.
Las poblaciones de esas levaduras van a variar dependiendo de la bodega. Hay, dependiendo, por ejemplo, en Bodega Constancia habrá más Beticus que Chericiensis, en las copas a lo mejor hay más Montuliensis, son distintas. Entonces, el recuento de levadura es distinto dependiendo de cada bodega y, por lo tanto, la evolución de esa flor en cada solera también es distinta.
So in each one of our wineries, we'll have certain different subgenomes of Saccharomyces that will be taking the leading role. We might have in one bodega the Saccharomyces beticus becoming more potent, for example. So it's learning how these different types of Saccharomyces yeast will affect the wine in different ways.
Aunque el sistema de criadera y solera es un sistema dinámico, un sistema en movimiento, yo digo que cada bota representa un mundo vivo completamente independiente.
We have, on top of the different types of genus of Saccharomyces yeast, we have, of course, each barrel, which can really be considered as its own universe. We have within each barrel a different expression of the same process, which is the Saccharomyces yeast consuming the nutrients in the wine, primarily nitrogenous materials and the organic acids, and then reproducing, firstly multiplying by 2, by 4, before very quickly we have this huge colony of yeast cells, which will eventually die and then start to aliment the wine once again. So we have this whole process that plays out very differently within each barrel.
Por lo tanto, podemos decir que el ciclo de la vida se desarrolla en su totalidad en cada bota, en cada vasija.
So in this way, we can say that the whole life cycle is completed in within each barrel of wine in the aging process, in the biological aging process.
And what is the taste of Fleur? If I'm tasting Fleur, what am I tasting? What does it taste like?
Si vienes alguna vez a Jerez, te lo daré a probar. La Fleur sabe fundamentalmente a mantequilla. Es un sabor como entre pan con mantequilla, podríamos decir. Es pan, mantequilla y sal, fundamentalmente.
If you come to the winery one day, Levy, I'll give you the opportunity to taste it. It's an interesting flavor. You could say that it tastes quite a lot like butter. It's quite full and round flavor, but at the same time, it gives you a quite a yeasty, bready component. You could even say that it tastes like butter on bread with a little bit of salt.
And do you find Fleur, you know, because it's in the air? So do you find it in other contexts of your everyday life? Like, do you ever find maybe you're making a potato soup and in the kitchen and the Fleur starts to grow over it? Or?
Absolutamente. Si pudiéramos mirar al microscopio las paredes de una bodega de Jerez, veríamos que están tapizadas de levadura. Están totalmente.
Indeed, absolutely. If you were to take a microscope to the walls of a bodega, you would see that it was absolutely covered with Fleur yeast. You could go even further. You could take a completely stable bottle of Tio Pepe, that's to say a bottle that's been filtered and stabilized, and you could serve a glass and leave that glass on a table in the bodega, and you could come back a week later and see development of the Fleur on top of the wine. I mean, really, I refer to this yeast as a super survivor. Its potential for colonization is just tremendous.
So speaking of filtering, not too long ago, you introduced a Tio Pepe en Rama, and how is that different than the normal Tio Pepe, and what led you to that introduction?
Bueno, realmente fue una decisión compartida con Martin Skelton, que era y es nuestro director en UK, en el Reino Unido.
In its origins, I was one day tasting in the winery with Martin Skelton, who is the managing director of Gonzalez Bias UK, United Kingdom distribution company, and also with Toby Morrell, the buyer for the Wine Society in the United Kingdom for the fortified wines. And the three of us were barrel tasting from barrel to barrel. And we were tasting Tio Pepe straight from the barrel, thick and really pungent and aromatic, full of Fleur yeast. And the conversation arose from there. And there was some interest from Toby, and then he proposed the idea, and Antonio says, well, if you can sell it, I'll bottle it for you. And so we did a saca. We bottled 16,000 bottles in total, and that's remained constant since then, that production. And the whole quantity was sold in the United Kingdom in 48 hours. I referred to it back then as a wild Tio Pepe. And Toby of the Wine Society referred to it as the Tio Pepe that you chew. You know, it's so textured. Since then, it's been something that's been really successful.
¿Y qué es Tio Pepe en Rama? Tio Pepe en Rama es la selección de las 60 mejores botas de esas 21.400 botas de las que hablábamos antes, embotelladas directamente, absolutamente directamente, sin filtro.
And so what is Tio Pepe en Rama? Well, Tio Pepe en Rama is the selection of 60 barrels, 60 of the best barrels of this 21,400 collection that we spoke about previously, bottled completely en Rama. That is to say, without any filtration, without any clarification, without any cold stabilization, straight from the barrel into the bottle, passing just through a thin, very fine, very minimal metal gauze, you know, which really only takes out any possible mosquitoes or flies that might have entered into the barrel for its various years aging.
As a consumer, how would I enjoy Tio Pepe and Rama as opposed to Tio Pepe? I mean, would I use it at a different time of year? Would I drink it with different food, or should I consume it at a different rate? Should I drink that bottle earlier?
Bueno, no, yo creo verdaderamente que entre Tio Pepe y Tio Pepe en Rama hay una ligera diferencia, sobre todo de poder.
Really, the difference between Tio Pepe and Tio Pepe en Rama can be described as a difference of organoleptic potency in expression. Really, when it comes to, if it comes down really to context, I suppose you could say. So, you know, if you're in a context where you're likely to be having a few different glasses of wine over the evening, then you'd be perhaps finding the perfect match with Tio Pepe. If you're looking to have a very small amount of something more expressive, then that's when you'd perhaps go for Tio Pepe and Rama. But really, when it comes to style of pairings with styles of cuisine, we're talking about very much the same cuisine. We begin with the jamón ibérico, of course, the charcuteries, the aperitif, early dishes, light tapas, for example, and goes perfectly well, of course, into the whole world of the different styles of Asian cuisines and so on.
And out of the Enrama project, also developed the Palmas project shortly after, and how did that all happen?
El proyecto de Tio Pepe Enrama y de Las Palmas, yo creo que es un proyecto conjunto. Era mi ilusión por sacar a la calle, sacar al mundo.
Really, they can be considered, these two projects of the Tio Pepe en Rama and the Las Palmas Finos, they can be considered as a joint project in a way, or certainly one that came from the other. And for me, it offered just this amazing opportunity to be able to take out to the street, to really take out to the world these amazing gems that we have aging in the cellar, to be able to take them out in their natural state and show them to people. So, of course, we have the Tio Pepe en Rama, the unfiltered, very select Tio Pepe. And then we have the Palmas project, which is really exploring the aging potential in the world of biological aging and its effect on Palomino wines. And this was really my desire. And the success of the en Rama project gave me so much confidence then to take this forward and bring out some of the further aged gems that we have aging in the winery. And this became the Las Palmas project.
So with en Rama and Las Palmas, would I expect that those wines would get better with bottle age once I purchased it?
Sí, evidentemente, eso lo hemos ido comprobando con el paso del tiempo. En las primeras ediciones, pues, no sabíamos qué es lo que iba a pasar. Realmente, no teníamos experiencia de embotellar absolutamente.
This is really something that we've been discovering over the passage of time since we began these projects. We've been watching how they develop. This really were the first projects of this kind in which we were bottling purely Enrama wines. And so really we've been discovering, along with the aging of the wines, obviously, as you can imagine, they do over time lose a certain freshness. But from that loss of freshness, of course, what they gain is all of the expressions from the process of autolysis, and a huge amount of complexity can build up in these wines. And in fact, I always say that real aficionados, wine aficionados, I recommend that they keep a few bottles of these Enrama bottlings to see how they will evolve with the passage of time.
What is the relationship between the Del Duque Amontillado and the Fino that we've already spoken about?
Realmente estamos hablando del mismo vino, del Duque, que es. Del Duque es un BORF, un vino categorizado por nuestro Consejo Regulador.
Well, really, we're talking about essentially different expressions of the same wine here. The Del Duque, of course, is our VORS 30 years aged Amontillado, which has gone through the whole process of biological aging, moving into the Amontillado oxidative aging process. And in fact, a very instructive tasting that I often do is to put together Tio Pepe next to Viña Abe, our young Amontillado, next to Del Duque VORS 30 years Amontillado. And I call this tasting the ages of Tio Pepe, because you really see the complete progression of biological aging as it moves then into oxidative aging in the Amontillado aging process.
One of the things you do that's somewhat interesting is that with the Palo Cortado Apostoles, you age Palomino Fino wine in old used Pedro Jimenez barrels.
No es exactamente tampoco así. Nosotros seleccionamos un palo cortado, en este caso de la Solera de Leonor, con 12 años.
It's not exactly that. Really, what we do in the production of Apostoles is we select Leonor Palo Cortado, which is a 12-year-old Palo Cortado, at which point we will make a small addition of Pedro Jimenez, creating a blend of 87% Palo Cortado, Leonor, and 13% of Pedro Jimenez. Then these two varietals will, after being, as we say in Jerez, married together, they will then be further aged in Solera to another minimum of 18 years, giving us an incredible harmony from these three very important factors, the American oak, the Palomino Fino, and the Pedro Jimenez. Now, it is true, of course, that this process takes place in barrels that have previously contained Pedro Jimenez, but the extraction of the Pedro Jimenez from the barrels really is quite small. And what really affects the balance, overall balance and finish of the wine is this small addition of the 13% of Pedro Jimenez.
And what was the impetus to do such a bottling, of which another one I'm not aware in the region?
No, es un vino histórico de González Díaz. O sea, la solera de Apóstoles data de 1845. Realmente es un vino histórico. Es un vino que después la clasificación de palo cortado y la regulación por parte del Consejo Regulador es posterior. Y realmente lo que es un vino histórico y único.
Really, it's a unique bottling. There isn't anything like it in the region. And importantly, it's an incredibly historic wine for González Bias. I mean, we've been producing Apostoles in this way since 1845, which, of course, vastly predates the denomination of origin. And so for us is something that not only is unique, but is also incredibly historic for our bodega. And also can be, well, in my opinion, creates the perfect harmony of sugar and sweetness from the PX with incredible potency of character from the Palo Cortado. Overall, just a perfect balance.
In a time before filtration, before temperature control, a way of kind of tempering the bracing character of a floor sherry by maybe adding something a little sweet to kind of balance it out, like a historical method of making a balanced wine.
Absolutamente, absolutamente de acuerdo. Era una manera de hacer amable un vino con un gran carácter.
Exactly. It was a way of creating lovely balance in a wine that was in its origins just powerfully, powerfully expressive.
And one of the things that's a little different about González Bias is that you source Pedro Jimenez from Jerez, which a lot of people would get it from Montilla. Is that right?
Bueno, no es absolutamente así. No es totalmente cierto. Hay una relación.
It's not exactly like that. In fact, there's an interesting agreement between the denomination of origin of Montilla and the denomination of origin of Jerez that permits wineries to be able to buy their wine from grapes grown in Montilla, also with the initial fermentation, that small partial fermentation already in place. The wines are brought into Jerez. González Bias has 16 hectares of Pedro Jimenez planted in the region of Jerez, but we are not yet completely self-sufficient, and we still do, we still are required to purchase some of the Pedro Jimenez from the region of Montilla. But we do hope that with time, perhaps in 5 or 6, even 7 years, we'll be completely self-sufficient with our needs for Pedro Jimenez, with our own vines in our own land, our own vineyard, terroir in the region of Jerez.
And what would be the difference between Pedro Jimenez grapes from Mantilla and Pedro Jimenez grapes from Jerez?
Bueno, la varietal es la misma. Realmente el único problema es que el cultivo de la Pedro Jimenez es muy caro.
Well, really, the first important difference is that it's an incredibly expensive process, the cultivation of Pedro Jimenez. Firstly, you have to leave the grapes on the vine for longer to mature further. And then, of course, you have this incredibly labor-intensive process of the soleo, in which after harvest, the grapes are dried out in the sun and they're turned bunch by bunch by hand to a point where they've lost up to 40% of their content in water through evaporation to exposure to the sun.
Somos conscientes de que es muy caro, pero que González Vía ha asumido ese riesgo. Somos la única bodega que tiene plantación de Pedro Jiménez Jerez, y aunque la maduración de la Pedro Jiménez es más tardía, porque somos una región muy cercana al mar, por lo tanto tiene menos intensidad solar a la hora del soleo, pues González Vía ha apostado por el reto de tener Pedro Jiménez propio, desde la viña hasta la botella.
And then, of course, secondly, is the difference between the two terroirs of Montilla and Jerez. We're talking about Montilla, which is a region that's quite substantially more inland and therefore has a hotter climate, and therefore you can expect a much faster maturation phase, and you can also expect a quicker drying process in soleo, whereas in Jerez the maturation of the grape takes longer, and then of consequence, of course, the drying of the grapes takes a little bit longer as well. All of this together, these factors together, mean that it's quite an investment on the part of the winery at González Bias. With what we're trying to achieve in the region, we're able to absorb this cost, but it is certainly very challenging, and that makes us part of the reason, really, why we're the only winery at this stage that are doing this process.
You also make the Noe. How should I understand that in the context of the larger scale of the production?
Un vino muy, muy exclusivo, con una producción muy pequeña, y es, tenemos un vino, una marca anterior, una.
The relationship of Noé, VORS, Pedro Jiménez, to the winery, you know, it can be explained almost as a parallel to the relationship between Tío Pepe and Del Duque, VORS, Amontillado. We indeed have a younger Pedro Jiménez, which is Nectar, which is aged to 8 years. And the wine from the Solera of Nectar will replenish the Solera of Noé, which is our VRS, over 30 years aged Pedro Jiménez. I always say, in fact, that people will say to me that Noé is one of the great dessert wines of the world. I don't agree at all. I think it's the dessert itself.
Yeah, because that's what I was going to ask you, was how would you use it in the context of a meal? And for you, it's a standalone beverage.
Exactamente. Se puede tomar solo. Yo muchas veces le recomiendo a los fumadores, que cada vez hay menos, un buen habano, un buen coiba.
Indeed, it's a wine that's just phenomenal on its own, so potent. But also, you know, it lends itself to some remarkable pairings, as you can imagine. To the smokers, each day there are less of them. I would recommend a good Cuban Havana cigar, but it also goes fantastically well with contrasting lighter dishes, such as, of course, ice creams. But one of my own personal favorites is to pair it, by extreme contrast, with acidic fruits. So, you know, anything that will bring acidity, which will give a lift to these heavy, richer, sweeter wines, such as the raspberries and exotic citrus fruits.
So should I understand both Palomino Fino and Pedro Jiménez as low-acid grape varieties?
En Jerez, increíblemente, la Palomino Fino y la Pedro Jiménez y la Moscatel, que es la tercera varietal, son unas varietales y uno fino con una.
Absolutely. I mean, it's really incredible in the region of Jerez, between the three varietals of the Palomino Fino and the Pedro Ximénez and the Moscatel, just how low the acid is on these young wines. You know, we're talking about volatile acid in a Palomino Fino, for example, of 0.18 or 0.2 going to, in the case of the Pedro Ximénez, 0.8, for example. It's incredibly low.
Realmente confunden mucho. Muchas personas piensan que los vinos de Jerez son vinos ácidos porque le aporta frescura en boca. Y no es acidez, es salinidad fundamentalmente.
A lot of people will see a sherry as a really acidic wine because it has this certain effect on the palate, but really it is a sense of freshness that we derive principally from the salinity of the wines, found from the salinity of our terroir.
So if they were high acid grape varieties, do you think the floor would fail to set on them?
Bueno, realmente la flor tiene unos límites de tolerancia muy, muy delicados. Tiene el límite de tolerancia de alcohol. Ya por encima de 16.
The flor, indeed itself, is incredibly sensitive, and it has various parameters, which each one, indeed, is very sensitive to its environment. So, for example, it has a tolerance of alcohol of around 16% by volume. You go above this rate and you create a hostile environment for it to survive in. Indeed, if the temperatures rise above 26, 27 degrees Celsius, that can start to be very problematic as well. And by extension, as you say exactly, a higher acid wine would create a very problematic environment for the reproduction of floor yeast.
Todos sabemos que en el mundo del vino, en el mundo de los vinos tranquilos, en muchas zonas, en vendimias muy básicas, poco ácidas, se acidifica el vino, porque de alguna manera es un protector del vino.
As we all know, in wine regions all around the world, when you have a less than ideal harvest, you have a process of acidification where acid is added to the wines because it's an important component in to be able to protect the wines as they age.
You've spoken a couple times about the importance to you of aroma, both in your childhood home and in the terms of the harvest when you receive grapes. You've also told us that the soleras often feed into each other. One solera becomes later another solera of a different kind of wine over time. How do the aromas change as grapes move into the winery and spend so much time in the bodega? What is the difference of aroma?
Van cambiando, evidentemente, cuando tenemos un vino joven, nosotros en Jerez le llamamos mosto, no es mosto, es el vino joven del año.
Absolutely, there's an important evolution of aromas here. When the young wines begin their life with us in the winery, or as we call them in Jerez, we call them musts. You know, they're not musts, they're after fermentation, this is the word we use for them. They come with powerful aromas of apple, of green apple, of fresh primary fruit. And as they go on to age in the winery, we of course see the development of the flor yeast. And as its metabolism increases, we then start to see the aromas produced by the reproduction of the flor yeast taking over these primary aromas. So we start to move more into baking aromas, for example.
Hay una cata muy demostrativa que es catar la solera desde la cuarta criadera hasta la solera cuarta, tercera, segunda y solera, y puedes ver cómo van cambiando todos esos aromas en la copa. Cómo esos aromas.
There's indeed a very demonstrative tasting which you can do in the winery, of course, where you taste each of the different layers of the criaderas. So that's to say, beginning with the fourth criadera, into the third criadera and the second criadera, alongside the solera, the final layer where we draw the wine from. And you can see just how these young, youthful, primary aromas will develop as the flor yeast begins to take over the aroma profile of the wine and move it into the secondary aromas of these baking aromas, for example.
So flor protects the palate of the wine from oxidation, but totally changes the aroma of the wine.
Claro, lo cambia absolutamente. Lo cambia totalmente. La flor no se parece en nada. Cuando vamos catando y no vamos comparando, nos puede parecer que no hay tanto cambio. Cuando tú pruebas una cuarta, criadero y pruebas la solera, ve la gran diferencia que hay.
Absolutely, the difference is huge. It's very dramatic change, and you can see this by tasting the fourth criadero alongside the solera. You'll see just how much that profile completely changes through its development, through its aging under the flor yeast.
So you also, as you previously referred to, have a large collection of vintage sherries at the winery, spanning several decades. If I were to understand a vintage release as opposed to a Solera release, what would I be thinking about? What are the differences in terms of organoleptic qualities of the actual wine?
Realmente, un vino de añada es la singularidad del año. En Jerez, como te comentaba antes, hasta mediados del siglo.
So really, a vintage sherry can be understood as being absolutely singular to that one vintage. Now, remember that up until the mid part of the 19th century, almost all of sherry was being sold in the vintage system. And since the very foundation of González Baias, we've been incredibly fortunate to have been maintaining each year an important collection of vintage sherries. So we have just the most fascinating collection of wines from 1840, from 1845, scattered throughout some of the most special vintages of the 19th century. We have the complete collection from the 20th century, which is something we're incredibly fortunate to have. And, well, what do we do with these wines? Well, every 3 or 4 years, we'll go tasting through the winery and we'll select a very special vintage, which we'll release in a small limited release, to take these wines out to show people. The current wine that we have is the Palo Cortado.
But I mean, is it a different kind of thing in terms of taste? If I were to give you two glasses, I would ask you to taste it blind and tell me which of the two was the vintage release and which was the Solera release of somewhat comparable age. Would you be able to do that? And why would you be able to tell the difference?
Podríamos distinguirlo fundamentalmente por cómo González Fía ha escogido su añada. González Fía escoge para añada lo mejor.
So really, the production of these vintage sherries depends on how they've been produced in the very beginning, of course. And with us, in our case, in González Baias, the way that these wines are selected is that we will take the most delicate, the most special, the most fine and elegant of our wines that would otherwise have been destined for biological aging. And we will then treat these wines in a production aging method that would be more applicable normally to oxidatively aged wines. So we would therefore select the free run juice, some of the most special terroir selected free run juice that we have, with a very light first press, for example, that gives us a wine that as it ages oxidatively will in fact be very light on the palate for a wine of this aging style, yet with the most incredibly elegant and aromatic potency on the nose.
So you told me that in 1980 there were 12,000 hectare of vines in the Jerez area, and now there's half of that. Do you foresee the vineyard area of the region getting larger once again now that sherry seems to be more popular?
No, yo creo que ahora está muy ajustado. Realmente, cuando el viñedo sea sobredimensionado para grandes producciones, al final no ha acarreado nada bueno. Yo creo que con el volumen de venta que tiene Jerez ahora y el volumen de viña plantada, está muy equilibrado. Yo creo que los pasos de crecimiento habrá que medirlo mucho en el futuro.
I think now we're at a stage where the vineyard area has really found its balance with the production of the wines. There was certainly a huge amounts of overproduction and overgrowing back when things started to change in the market. And now with the reduction that we've seen, we've come to a point, in my opinion, where we're at a really very good balance between the vineyard area that we have and the sales demand that we have. Now, this is very balanced at this time. So to look to the future and to see any growth in vineyard space, for example, would be something that would happen much further down the line and would have to be done slowly and carefully.
And what else might the future imply for Gonzales BS? Family-run company, two generations making the wine, very large producer in the context of Jerez. What's the next generation likely to bring forth?
Fundamentalmente, fíjate, en González Vía estamos ya en la quinta generación actualmente trabajando de la familia González. Nuestro presidente y nuestro vicepresidente pertenecen a la quinta.
Well, what do we expect from the future? Well, really, we are now in the fifth generation of the González family that have been running González Baez since 1835. Our president and our vice president are both from that fifth generation, and we now have the sixth generation and the seventh generation with us in the world. And so really what we can expect from them in the future is a continuation of the work that is already in place. That is, you could describe it as the opening of a fan from the region of Jerez into other regions of Spain. On the Spanish winemaking map, we have Bodegas Beronia in La Rioja. We have Cava Villarnau in the Sansorni region of Catalunya, Finca Constancia in Castilla, Finca Moncloa in the region of Cádiz, and Viñas del Vero up in the denomination of origin of Somontano. And really, this is something that will certainly continue to be important through the development and the future of González Baez, is this diversification. However, the heart of the company is still in Jerez. This is where we are all based, still in Jerez. It's where our president is still based. And in some way, you can say that that Jerez and our winery, González Baez, will remain the heart and soul of our wine projects. As the company continues to develop and grow, everything comes back to Jerez, which really defines the philosophy of the company.
Antonio Flores of González Baez, he enjoyed returning to a home that smelled like sherry, and he dreamed about his father leaving the door open to the winery. Thank you very much for being here today.
Thank you, Levy.
Antonio Flores of González Baez. A while back, I was asked why sherry is more popular today than it was 10 years ago, and my answer was actually pretty straightforward. It's because the wines are better. Seriously, really think about it. It's been sort of taken as a given that sherry, maybe because it has such a long history, just doesn't change that much. But look at what's out there today and see how much alteration has really happened to the scene. And Rama bottlings are a good example of something that just wasn't even available to consumers a decade ago. And now there are several to choose from. Plus, have you had the Una Palmas Fino? I mean, seriously, have you had the Una Palmas? Because it's freaking fantastic! Wines like this are the reason that sherry is really more popular today than it's ever been in a long time. For real. I mean, the amazing thing about it is that the wine is just heartrending good, like amazing, the Una Palmas, and it is offered out for like peanuts, like really nothing. It's super inexpensive for what it is. Plus, we're going to do something special here, and I'm going to go ahead and offer you an even deeper discount on what's already a low price. Crush Wine and Spirits will take off 10% of the original price for the Una Palmas, taking it down to $28.95 a bottle for you because you listen to this show. All you have to do is call Crush at 212-980-9463 and use the offer code IDTT for me, or use that same promo code online at crushwineco.com, and then you can take advantage of the pricing on what's really one of the great wines of the world, the Una Palmas. Call Crush Wine and Spirits and ask for the special deal available to podcast listeners. Thanks for listening. You can find us on our website at alldrinktothatpod.com, where you can find information about purchasing a t-shirt if you'd like, or find back episodes. You can find us on Facebook. We're on Twitter as well at drinktothatpod. And I'm on Instagram with some wine photos, probably too many wine photos, really. But, you know, if you like wine, maybe you do if you listen to the show. It's Levy Opens Wine with L-E-V-I at the start there. Levy Opens Wine on Instagram. In terms of the show itself, one of the real frustrations that we have is that oftentimes people treat it like a secret. It's like that special restaurant that they really like, that when they go, they like it because they can sit down immediately. Not a lot of people know about it. It's not too crowded. Well, the thing with restaurants like that is a lot of times they close. And the reason they close is because they don't reach enough clientele. And what I would suggest to you is if you like the show, you can help us out a lot by sharing it with your friends. or sharing it with your enemies, really. I really don't care. But make your voice heard in support of the show if you like the show. You can do that by sharing a post on Instagram. You can do that by retweeting a tweet. You can do that by leaving a comment on in iTunes, which is super helpful, actually, or subscribing to the show on iTunes, which is equally as helpful. They're the kind of things that go a real long way in terms of a small show like this that tries to over-deliver with content and tries to give you the best each week, actually a couple times a week. We could always use more support, frankly, and if you're listening, thank you for doing that. Please take the next step and help introduce other people to the show as well by sharing with your friends or leaving a comment on iTunes so that our ratings go a little bit higher and we can get the word out a little bit better and more people will be drinking better wine in a more informed fashion. We're there for you. Please help us out on the other side. We love you.
Yo siempre digo unas palabras de un poeta americano, sudamericano, Octavio Paz, que decía que la única patria que tiene el ser humano es su infancia.